when you were writing your thesis the first year and,
yes.
and teaching these labs.
Yes. And my thesis was typed by a secretary in the Department of Geology, because the chemistry department had no secretary even at that time. Everything was done longhand or this way or so.
And you had some contact in the geology department.
Yes. And there was a very nice elderly woman named Miss Rice who had spare time. She was paid privately by one of the professors of geology. The university didn't hire any secretaries then, except, I suppose, for administration.
Well, things have changed in some ways.
Yes.
Did you meet Carl Compton around this time, or?
Yes, I don't know when I first met Carl Compton, but I had taken courses in physics as an undergraduate, but not with Compton. I had one with old Dean McGee, who was dean of the faculty and was a physicist of the old school. He was a very polished gentleman, and I think he taught me thermodynamics. But anyway, it seemed to be fairly easy. There was plenty of space in the physics lab, so they gave me a place to work, first in the basement, and then I was promoted to the to the ground floor. So most of my early research was done there. I did have one piece of work on, well, that was starting dielectric research there. I did one piece of research on partial vapor pressures, which I did in the top floor of the old chemistry lab. The windows didn't fit when the north winds blew, the windows would rattle, and the drafts would sweep across the room. But that was the laboratory Professor Foster, who was the lecturer in general chemistry, and I persuaded him to write his own textbook. Instead of using Alexander Smith, he had his lectures all written out on notes, so he wrote his own textbook and very kindly invited me to be a partner, but I just was a person of limited physical capacity, and I couldn't do my share of writing a textbook and to keep my research going the way I wanted it to go. So I declined. But he had this big drafty laboratory adjacent to his office, and I had a desk in his office anyway, because that was adjacent to the freshman chem labs in those days. And so here was this big empty room that worked on partial vapor pressures.
You picked up that problem. You were probably, I imagine you were thinking about the direction to go in for a research program.
Yes, I used to go and talk to Carl Compton about choice of a research program. And I thought of three possibilities. One that was a very vague one. Chemistry was primitive in those days. Jean Perrin, who was the leading French physical chemist, had proposed new ideas about infrared. and they were supposed to have, infrared was supposed to have mysterious effects on chemical reaction, which, and I thought that sounded like an interesting thing to try. And then people talked about atom smashing in those days, and Lester Cook, who was a professor in the physics department, had an idea for developing high voltage by having two brass discs quite close together and charging them up, and having that, the space between the two discs, a break in a circuit, which included a setup for discharge through a tungsten wire. And the idea was to put a tremendous voltage. They didn't know how to get high voltage in the normal fashions, what was normal nowadays, in those days. And Cook was going to have a revolver mounted, pointing it at these two discs, and he was going to close the circuit by shooting a bullet passing between the two discs. You see, it would penetrate, they were thin discs, and close the circuit, which would put a very high voltage on this tungsten wire, which was in the circuit. And that appealed to me quite strongly. I was very seriously attracted. But I found that Fuller Van Jerry went at General Electric, the WENDT, had, wait, this is a long time ago, about 60 years, and Wendt was working on it, but when he finally got to going somewhere, he was at, let me leave Wendt's name out. As I say, there was a man at General Electric who had essentially the same idea, and he was way at least a year ahead of me, with the resources of General Electric at his disposal. So it looked to me like a hopeless competition if I undertook that. And later he never was able to try it because he said they needed the high voltage that he had prepared to test insulation breakdown. So he never got an example of the General Electric lab at that time was probably the best industrial research lab in the country, and yet they had to deny a man the chance of smashing the atom in order to test some insulation. It very soon developed away from a situation like that. Well, anyway, and I discussed the things with Compton, and he told me about these new developments and ideas of dielectrics that he thought were worth investigating. And that appealed to me. As a matter of fact, he had already started a young assistant professor in the physics department named Zahn on measuring the dielectric constants of gases. And so I started measuring the dielectric constants constants and liquids, I knew absolutely nothing about the background or the techniques and concepts. I was unfamiliar with it too. So we didn't work together. He just tossed that out as an idea. He was just a terribly nice, outgoing man with tremendous ability backing it, ability to handle people and as well as ideas. Well, I started there as my first graduate student. Was a physics graduate student, first year physics graduate student who had been in Princeton undergraduate. And there were Princeton undergraduates whose ideas about the weekend were different. For them, the weekend started Thursday and continued through Monday.
And
that was about Joe's idea. So we didn't progress very well. We became very good friends, but there wasn't much progress.
What was his name?
Joe Boyce. Mm-hmm. We later separated, and he then on Compton went to MIT. He took Joe along with him as an instructor or assistant professor in the physics department there. And Joe later left and became ultimately dean of the graduate school at Illinois Tech in Chicago. He was a very nice fellow with great deal of energy, but he was not a devoted research man. Mm-hmm.
The topic that he started working on was at once relatively theoretical and also something that bridged the gap between physics and physical chemistry.
Yes.
It was so, and this, it's clear from what you've been saying that Compton's influence was important. How did your colleagues in chemistry feel that you're taking up a topic that was more chemical physics than physical chemistry?
They didn't mind at all. I had a free hand.
Were there many other people working in that area at that time? Not just at Princeton, but elsewhere.
There was a man named Williams at Wisconsin, J.W. Williams. And this ultimately developed into the determination of molecular dipole moments. And Williams, I think, got a little head start on me and was doing very well, but then he gave it up and switched into biochemistry. And he made the National Academy very early by his work in biochemistry. If he'd stayed on in dielectrics, he might never have made the National Academy. He was a very bright fellow.
He did a lot of early work with the ultracentrifuge, didn't he?
Did he? I've forgotten.
I think so. He made quite a name for himself in that area.
Yeah.
He
was a very good chap and an extremely nice fellow.
Had Compton told you about Debye's work then? Was that one of the things you were discussing, or did you discover that on your own?
I really don't know. I knew about Debye's work very early, and I think my first serious graduate student came to me from the Bell Telephone Laboratories, S. O. Morgan, and he really worked on the thing, and we got results. And ultimately, he went back to the Bell Labs after he got his degree here, his PhD, and became have the chemistry division at the Bell Labs.
There were, and you had several other students who were at Bell Labs, notably Bill Baker and Bruce Hannay.
Yes, they were my star students, particularly Bill Baker. Well, Bruce Hannay was almost as good, but Bill had greater breadth, I guess.
Well, we'd like to come back to them. We're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves.
Yes.
They were about 15 years later. With Morgan, well, as you said, Morgan and you managed to get some interesting results, but already before then you published a couple of pieces in the Philosophical Magazine and Jax that laid out some very interesting early ideas on how to relate the studies of dipole moments to new developments in the electronic theory of valence.
Yes.
And what sort of reaction did you get to these first few papers in this area? Do you recall what people had to say about the work?
They were favorable because a dipole moment was a thing fairly easy to understand and this is getting ahead a little, but I do remember using dipole moment measurements to attack one of the organic theories which involves structure, and Jim Conant wrote me a brief note saying he hoped I would send a copy of a reprint of that paper, bound in black, to Maurice Karash, Chicago. Karash and I became quite good friends. It's quite, well, I didn't send the black binding.
Sounds like Conant had quite a sense of humor. And another early result, one of the first things you published with Morgan was to show that some of the current ideas about benzene's structure were not quite accurate.
Yes, because I think that was probably, that could easily have been the most important thing I did, because just at that time, X-ray analysis hadn't gotten very far, and the X-ray people, the physical chemists were kind of unwilling to accept this planar benzene ring. The structure of carbon in its compounds didn't lend itself to a planar ring. It was much easier for the physical chemist to picture a cyclohexane ring than the benzene ring. And the dipole moment gave a very simple proof that the old Kekulé model was right.
Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of result that everybody hopes for, I think.
Yes.
That something that most chemists in a number of areas can immediately see as significant. That must have been very gratifying to see those kinds of results that soon.
Yes, that and. It was hard getting research done in those days because there were 15 graduate students allowed to the entire department. The graduate school was so small, and Hugh Taylor was going ahead fast, and Walter Jones took them, so there wasn't much left. If I had one graduate student, I was pleased. Mm-hmm. If I had two, I was happy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Where, in addition to finding capable and willing students to help in the work, where, I suppose one thing that appealed to you about the dipole moment work was that it didn't cost much to do, as opposed to the high voltage work that you had considered doing.
Yes, well, the high voltage. In those days, we had no conception of research expenses, such as soon became the routine. Because I hadn't got the exact figures in mind, but somewhere along that time, the Public Service Corporation of New Jersey gave the chemistry department, I think it was $30,000 to be spent in 3 years, or it may have been $50,000 to be spent in 5 years. Anyway, it was about the order of $10,000 a year for the entire department. Hugh Taylor was wondering how we were going to spend all that money. He talked to me about it, asked if I could use some, and I said sure. But I never dreamed of these vast modern sums for research, and we got on very well with that money. And they were, you could get a postdoc for $1,500 a year in those days, and somewhere along in there I don't know when I got a postdoc.
Who was that?
I can't remember now. I'd have to look back.
Yeah, we can certainly check that
list.
We can just, undoubtedly you published some papers with him. So
yes. It may not have been very as early as that.
What setup did you have when you began this program of work on dielectrics and dipole moments? You were saying you did it in the physics department for...
I had one room.
Did you need much equipment? Where did you get the equipment?
Well, I needed a precision condenser to make precise capacitance measurements. You couldn't buy one in those days. So I designed one from... And the university mechanic, we had no mechanic in the chem lab, nor I don't believe the physics department had one then. There was a little elderly man, Mr. Fisher, who was the mechanic for the entire university. And it took him about a year to make this precision condenser. It wasn't too bad a job, but it was hardly good enough. And then the General Radio Company started work just about that time and made a very good precision condenser, but that cost all $200 or $300, and I didn't have that much. My personal salary when I started was $1,800, and I was getting more by that time, but not much.
But not enough to spare $300 for a piece of apparatus.
Yes. So I applied to the American Philosophical Society, of which I became a member rather early, and they turned me down. It wasn't the sort of, they would, but I guess by that time this money came from public service. So I got started with that, and the shop could make measuring cells, and or you could get it done away for small sums. But everything moves slowly, of course.
What other sorts of sources of support did you and your colleagues go to at that period in the mid-20s? Things quickly changed in a few years, but you mentioned the American Philosophical Society and this money from public service.
You know, I don't know. When we had that 50,000 or 30,000, just something of that magnitude, which and people had very modest ideas. I don't know where I got my money. I think the first real money I ever got for research was from the Office of Naval Research after the First World War.
Mm-hmm. That was in about 1945 or 46?
Yeah, 46.
So that was sometime later.
In the 1920s, it was also the time that the General Education Board was getting ready to give money to Princeton to endow scientific research. Do you remember discussions in the department about hopes for
That comes back to me that there was money. Probably I got some money from them, but certainly not much. It didn't take very much to do research in those days.
Do you feel that the money which was coming in from public service and other sources helped to set up any new type of research programs in the past few years?
I doubt if it did. It must have been to some extent.
I mean, do you recall any specific programs which grew as a result of having access to these new funds?
No. I think it was a matter of having a program and scrounging around to see, get the necessary dollars to buy what equipment was needed, and then sometimes the department would get a few dollars.
Were your colleagues doing any industrial consulting in the 1920s, or was that a development that came later on?
Hewlett consulted regularly for the Bureau of Mines. But I don't think he did much in industrial work. And I think it's quite possible that Taylor may have done some.
Hadn't Morgan come from Bell Labs and then gone back after studying with you?
Yes.
Did Bell Labs ever offer to help you with your research, or did you have any consulting arrangements with them eventually?
No, I don't think so.
Because the kind of work that you were doing fit in very nicely with their program.
Yes.
In the 1920s, there was also an attempt to establish cooperative research among a number of departments. Astronomy, Russell was involved.
Yes.
And to a certain degree, chemistry. Do you recall discussions or actual work that was done?
I don't remember anything about the formal arrangements for that. I was never involved. In a way, it was complete cooperation in my case with the physics department, because I was being given my space and janitor service, and when glass blowing, because they got a glass blower there, ultimately the chemistry department did, but I was almost next door to the glass blower. And they had a man named Chester Grove, or Groves, who had been a janitor, I think, and they pulled him in to set up physics lecture experiments. And he had a remarkable sense for apparatus. So much so that when I designed a new piece of apparatus. I used to go and I would sketch it out and then go and show it to Chester to see what suggestion he could make to make it more compact or simpler to build. And that was entirely in the physics department.
Just one second.